Curtis on the line? Welcome to episode 8 of The Infectious Myth. I'm your host, David Crow, and I'm very pleased to welcome Curtis Hagen. I hope I got that right. A philosopher. Pardon me? Hagen. Oh, hey, not ha. Yes. Okay. Curtis Hagen, a philosophy professor from SUNY Plattsburgh. And from your webpage at the State University of New York, Plattsburgh, it says you're an associate professor in philosophy, specializing in early Chinese philosophy, particularly Confucianism. But it also says, and this is probably more important for our talk today, that you've developed an interest in applied epistemology, which answers the question, what is knowledge, especially the assessment of conspiracy theories and issues concerning when one should defer to experts. It also says you like Ultimate Frisbee.
Right.
So I hope I'm not taking you away from an Ultimate Frisbee game.
No.
The way the weather's been out east, probably less opportunities for that.
It was a beautiful day here yesterday, but...
Yes, it's always a beautiful day when I'm busy, and when I have a free day, it's always snowing here or something. Before I get to you, Curtis, I'm just going to read a little bit of feedback that we had from episode 7, which was the authors of the book on vaccinations, Dissolving Illusions.
Sure.
Roger Swan wrote and said, "Excellent show, David. It was delightful hearing the voices of the authors of this marvelous book." Another man who wanted to be listed as just an admirer said, "I just realized how clever the title, The Infectious Myth, is. How slow am I?" And we will not address that question. The woman from Dissolving Illusions, that was Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who is a nephrologist and now an alternative medical practitioner as well, was so articulate. What a great guest. It's great what you're doing. Where else would I get this information? So hopefully we'll get some similar feedback from this discussion. So, Curtis, I hope I can call you Curtis.
Sure, no problem.
How did you get involved as a philosopher in this question of conspiracy theories, deferring to experts, the questions around how we acquire knowledge, how do we know if something's factual or a myth or whatever? How did you get involved in this area?
Well, it actually started in the summer of 2006. That was after my first full year of teaching here.
Mm-hmm.
And during the summer, I was in Korea, and I had a flight, and my brain was backwards, you know, in the sense of sleeping all day and staying up all night, not being able to sleep at night.
Right.
And it was in that state that... I YouTube had just sort of become, you know, watching videos on the internet was a new thing, and so to try to keep myself awake during the day, I was entertaining myself with some videos, and one of the ones I happened to watch was Loose Change about 9/11.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it really started with that, you know, and then I was awake all night thinking about. All right, there were some interesting claims made, but how do I really know? I mean, is there something that I can do, you know, to verify this, to really know myself without sort of having to just trust somebody?
Right, because I find, like last week I was talking about the vaccination issue, I'll read pro-vaccination people and it all sounds coherent, and then I'll read the critics and it all sounds coherent, and I'm thinking, you know, I can't make up my mind just by reading this stuff. I have to actually get into it and do some research, because otherwise I have to pick a side, and
right.
I don't like doing that.
Right, and what good is it to just pick a side, right?
Yeah, that's not acquiring knowledge. And if
right.
I pick the side that's, quote, scientific or the establishment, because that's, I feel more comfortable with that, you know, basically it's a faith-based belief, which is equivalent to picking a religion, you know?
Yeah, and which side you pick may depend largely on sort of your worldview assumption, you know, whether or not and this is an issue that I've gotten interested in, whether or not you come from an assumption of trust, that is to say, that the supposed epistemic authorities and the supposed sort of knowledge-producing institutions, as they're called, are trustworthy, or whether you come from a sort of a skeptical, doubtful, you know, and you want to be an independent, critical thinker kind of attitude.
Well, I think we really see a division in America. I was just reading about that rancher in Nevada who's grazing his cattle on public lands and doesn't believe in the U.S. government and doesn't think he should pay for the use of public lands. There's sort of this far right that's opposed to often science, opposed to government, opposed to many things. But then on the left, which considers itself sometimes more rational about things, they also have blind spots. They feel like they need to support the government theory on 9/11, vaccination, climate change. There's this whole list of things that if you're a liberal, you have to believe in, and it becomes just as rigid in their beliefs as some of these people who most people would say are kind of wacky on the right hand side.
right. But even if it doesn't sound as wacky or something. Just like a good contrast or an analogy here is the contrast between Bush and Obama.
Right.
Obama sounds much more reasonable.
Right.
But their actual practice isn't really all that much different.
Yeah, I mean, Obama has thrown out more illegal immigrants from America than Bush ever did. And he's killed more people with drones, and he's done nothing to deal. He's done nothing to punish the people who tortured in the CIA programs. So yeah, I agree. He appeals to liberals because he's so smooth, and people really want to believe what he says, but his actions speak louder.
Right, and he prosecutes whistleblowers.
Yes, more than anybody else, more than Bush ever did, more than any president. I mean, I think he's a tool of the system, and I don't think that most people want to be tools of the system, but they do tend to take sides. I know in Canada we have socialized medicines. There's a real feeling that people on the left, in order to support socialized medicine, have to support everything about the medical system. And so you can't really criticize the medical system because then you're undermining our precious socialized medicine system that everybody loves.
Right.
So, but it's not rational.
Yeah. If I could get back sort of to my story.
Yeah.
So it started with the concrete case of 9/11. And one of the things that I thought that I could evaluate. I mean, I do have a degree in electrical engineering, so I have some familiarity with science and whatnot, and wasn't difficult to say, okay, they claim that the building, you know, fell at 9.2 seconds or something, and they say that that's, they say that the commission report says that the buildings fell in 10 and 11 seconds. Okay,
right.
So you can look that up, and it's true that that's what the commission says. Okay, that's just a matter of that's what the commission says. That doesn't mean that's what actually happened, but at least it's the claim that that's what the commission said is true. So you can at least evaluate that and say, okay, I got that. They also claim that free fall is 9.2 seconds or so. And then you say, okay, well, I can check that too. I can look up the height of the building.
Right.
And just do a very simple problem and find out, okay, verify that too. And then you say,
I think
all right, 9.2.
Newton could have calculated that.
Yeah. 9.2 and seconds and 10 seconds and 11 seconds. Boy, that's awful close. I mean, already you're just thinking, all right, that sounds kind of suspicious. I mean, at least, you know, then you've got, okay, I've got a reason of my own, I'm not depending on anybody here, to say, you know, maybe this needs a little further looking into.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the start. And then I did my own little bit more sophisticated calculation, where I thought, all right, so how? I mean, it's close enough. First, I should acknowledge that the commission, I think, are factually wrong when they say 10 and 11 seconds. I mean, there's a lot of smoke. It's hard to say. And this, and by admitting this, I'm actually saying something that's more generous to the official story.
Right.
Because if the buildings actually fell more like 14 seconds rather than 10 or 11, that gives more leeway to say, okay, that's further away from the, you know, it's not as fast. So it's less suspicious.
Right.
Okay, and so I think that's really the truth. But even at 14 seconds, that's awful fast.
That's exactly right. I had the strange privilege of watching a building being imploded in Las Vegas. I think it was October 27th, 1996, and I know it was October 27th because that's my birthday, and it kind of stuck in my mind. And they blew up a hotel on the corner, the main corner in on the Strip in Las Vegas. I think it was the Dunes or the Sands or something. And you know, so there was all this big frou-frou, and then, you know, there was these bangs as the floors were exploded, and the whole thing just sank. And in like, it was only like 10 stories or something. So in like 5 seconds, there's this pile of rubble on the ground. But the whole flow, like it looked like a liquid as it was falling, and stuck in my mind. And when I watched 9/11, at the collapse of the buildings, it looked remarkably similar.
Right. And then especially Building 7, then, you know, you go into other things, and Building 7, and now they finally admit, and it took time for people to present the case, and then, you know, it wasn't until, I don't remember what, 2009 or something, when the when NIST, National Institute for Standards and Technology, finally came out with their official report on Building 7. But there, you know, they were they first said it fell 40% slower than pre-fault, Building 7.
Right.
And it was only after they were publicly challenged on that, and this physics teacher, David Chandler, did a YouTube presentation where he showed how you can, with the publicly available video and physics software, anybody can do the math and do the steps to do the calculation themselves and see that for the first let's call it 2.25 seconds, it falls very, very close to free fall. And so given that public challenge, NIST revised their report, and the final version of the final report actually acknowledges free fall, just absolute free fall, 9.81 meters per second squared, for 2.25 seconds, during which time, and you might think, well, 2.25 seconds, that's not very much. It fell over 100 feet at freefall, you know? And so that is something, okay, well, what's the answer for that? What's the explanation for that? And I can talk a little more about that later, maybe, but...
Well, I think one thing that I've encountered several times is there's the issue of the sort of the factual data, and then there's the explanation. When I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago talking about something completely different, needle exchange programs in HIV and AIDS, and I presented this data, and somebody said, well, you have to explain this. This data is counterintuitive. I cannot explain this data with my understanding of the world. And I said, that's, you know, you're putting the cart before the horse. If there's data that you cannot explain, it's fine to say, okay, we need to really look at this data to see if it's true or not. But if the data is true, appears to be true, then you have to start examining your assumptions. You can't just discard the data because you can't figure out how it could possibly be true.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem with 9/11 is that people say, well, then who did it? Who did it? You have to explain who did it. But it's like, well, first you have to establish what happened. Then it's the question of who did it.
Yeah. So after having those kinds of, you know, thinking about that, those kinds of thoughts about 9/11, And further, you know, and spending quite a good deal of time on it, I started to look at a broader issue of the philosophy of conspiracy theories. And it turned out my timing was pretty good there, because in the year 2006, a book came out called Conspiracy Theories, The Philosophical Debate, edited by David Cody. And it has essays in there. Many of them were published earlier in philosophy journals. One
right.
of them was in the Journal of Philosophy itself. And they're by a handful of people, and then there's some extra new articles. The work of David Cody, the editor, and also Charles Pigden, I thought was really good. I think they basically win the argument.
Right.
Of course, they hold my position, which is that there's basically two positions. The one position is people are trying to explain why it is that conspiracy theories in general are unwarranted. There are sort of a class of ideas that you can just kind of dismiss because
right.
it's a conspiracy theory. And they're trying to explain why it is that you can just dismiss them.
Right.
So that's one camp. And the other camp, that includes me and David Cody and Charles Pigden, says, not so fast. The fact of the matter is, some conspiracy theories have been borne out.
Right.
So you can't just dismiss them. You have to take each one case by case. And
right.
it just isn't a shortcut.
I think that's a very North American weakness, is to look for a way to establish something without having to think about it. I was a manager for a while, and it seemed to me that what you were supposed to do as a manager is to take all these measurements of people that work for you and then put them in an equation, and out of that you could come up with who was your best employee. But I would step back and say, I already know that. I know who's really good working for me, and I know who's got problems. Why do I need to sort of fake up this equation with all of these numbers on all of these categories of behavior? But I think some managers want to say, okay, if I can plug this all in, I can make an unbiased decision without actually having to think about it. And maybe people want that for a conspiracy theory. Let's put in some data, and then I can tell you if it's true or false. Or maybe if they're all false, then I don't even have to think about it at all.
Well, it would sure be nice if you didn't have to do all that work, right, and
yeah.
think about each issue, and you could just dismiss, things. Because
right.
it really is, they are all, if you take a major conspiracy, 9/11, JFK, those kinds of things, they really are rabbit holes. I mean, once you get in, it goes down and down and down, and it connects. There's like a, underground tunnels connecting these things.
Right.
And you almost get lost in there. And then if you follow the debate back and forth, you find that there is a debate back and forth. There's a point and counterpoint.
Right.
And it takes a lot of effort to keep up, even with just one major conspiracy theory. That's why I'm interested, broadly, but, I can only really speak, knowledgeably about 9/11 because it just... everything gets too complicated too quickly.
But there are conspiracy theories that have been proven and are now accepted as conspiracy theories. I think you mentioned in Italy, I think in the 1960s, the right in Italy, the government plus shadowy forces on the right of the spectrum, was staging bombs which they wanted to blame on the left. And in
right.
fact, there's a recent movie... Italian Romanzo di un Strage, the romance of a massacre, which is where they planted this bomb, and then they captured some poor pathetic anarchist, and they started questioning him, and he apparently jumped out of a window. I think it was like Steve Biko. I think everybody knows he was pushed, but by pushing him out the window, they silenced the person they said was guilty, and then they didn't really have to go through the court proceedings, which might have found him innocent.
Yeah.
But that's sound now accepted.
Yeah, sound familiar. I mean, there's a certain theme. We think of being pushed out of the window. We think of also A Terrible Mistake is the book about it. The guy, CIA guy, who got pushed out the window.
I don't know this one.
There was LSD. The CIA was giving people LSD,
right?
Unbeknownst
right.
to them, and.
That was controversial for a while. Like the CIA, they wouldn't give LSD to people, but now we know that that's true. They did.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Oswald. I mean, Oswald was made to disappear, and that's a theme. One thing, I don't know if you're familiar with the term SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy. This was coined by Lance DeHaven Smith, who, by the way, just came out last year with a book called Conspiracy Theory in America. I'm just finishing reading that now. And he's published in, you know, academic journals as well. He does quite good work. But anyway, he's come up with this acronym, SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy, mm-hmm. as a way of talking about a category that's similar to conspiracy theories, but without, you know, the baggage.
Right, right.
And the thing that's different about it is he looks, rather than taking at taking a particular incident as an isolated thing in itself, he looks at known and suspected SCADs as a group and says, okay, what are the patterns that we see? What are the similarities between cases here, and looks at it that way.
Right, right. You talked to me about one called Operation Northwoods, which is now, you said, is widely accepted. Can you describe what happened there? And because that seems like a strange conspiracy, but a strange government conspiracy, but it's actually true, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I guess you could say it's a true conspiracy. It didn't actually. The conspiracy part is true. There was a conspiracy. There was a plan. It wasn't carried out.
Mm-hmm.
The plan was presented to Robert McNamara, and it was either McNamara or Kennedy who basically said no, to rejected the plan. But the document describing the plan was found in, I believe it was 2001, by James Bamford.
Okay.
And anyway, There are many facets to it, but the one that I highlighted in my article was this plan, and it's the detail of this thing that really makes it interesting, as well as some analogy to some other things with 9/11. But the plan was to load up a plane with people pretending to be college students, say.
Right.
And they would be going on a trip to somewhere in South America, and they'd be going, the flight path would take them near Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But this plane would just land, and then a similar plane, which would be a drone with no one on it, would take off. So already in the early 60s, they're talking about flying planes remotely.
Right.
Okay. So they would take off with this drone, and the drone would have a recorded Mayday signal that would be sent off that would blame the Cubans, and then it would be blown up.
Right.
So it looks like, and then they leave it, and they explicitly say this, they leave it to other people who get the Mayday signal, right, for them to report what happens. So they don't have to sell the story. So that's exactly how they present the plan. And they talk about, you know, sort of details about what the kinds of things that they need to do to maneuver this to get this thing to work.
Right. I mean, one of the problems I can see, two problems I can see with this theory that sort of has some bearing on 9/11. One is that, you know, there's differences between two planes. There could be some differences, and so when people find the wreckage, it might not be identical. Somebody may have made a mistake and left some obvious difference from the plane that supposedly was blown up but actually wasn't. And then there's the question of all these people that get on the plane and who are supposed to disappear. Like, how do you make people disappear? How do you create people that you can disappear? Because if those people who were on the plane start to reappear, then obviously they didn't get blown up in a plane over Cuba.
Right, right. Well, I think the answer is, unfortunately, you know, it's not really that difficult to do if you're cold-hearted enough. You just land the plane and kill them.
Oh, okay. So you kill them, but then you could just blow up the plane. Like, you could fly
you could.
A plane with a bomb on it, and you could blow it up over Cuba and blame it on a rocket from Cuba.
You could. You wouldn't have to switch the planes. And I don't know that they did switch the planes. I'm just saying that if they wanted to switch the planes for one reason or another, they could just kill all the people.
Right, right. I understand.
But this was
a documented inside the U.S. government conspiracy, and the documents are now available, right?
Right, the Project Northwoods, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And anybody can, you know, just Google it and read it. It's pretty amazing. Another good document is I think it's called A Study of Assassination, mm-hmm. The CIA document, and it's curious because, of course, they don't. I mean, it starts off saying that, you know, murder is prima facie wrong, you know, and then they don't advocate, you know, assassinating anybody, but they go into a great deal about of detail about how to do it, you know.
And is this a CIA document? Or?
This is a CIA document. Yeah, it's essentially a manual. I mean,
right.
It's in a sense it's not explicitly quite billed as a manual, but the content. I mean, it can be read as a manual essentially.
And we know now, of course. I mean, there are some cases where it's still controversial, but we know for sure that the CIA was involved with assassination of some. Democratically elected leaders, for example, Operation Condor, which overthrew Salvador Allende in Chile and installed General Pinochet, and then there was the Iran, the president or premier of Iran in the 50s was killed by the CIA. I mean, there's quite a long list of known...
Was he killed? I don't know that he was killed, but he was overthrown.
Overthrown. In Chile, I don't know if it was intended that Salvador Allende would be killed, but he was killed before the end of the day of the coup.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's just unquestionable that we've been involved in assassinations overseas. The only question is, well, did they come home and do it here, too?
Yeah.
It's not outrageous, I don't think, to think that, well... It's something that could be looked into,
yeah,
and not just dismissed.
I certainly don't think it's beyond, it's unreasonable to think that there's been some domestic assassinations. It, obviously, there's things they need to keep quiet because if everybody knew that a certain car crash was actually a murder, it would obviously have. Really big pushback from the American people or the people whatever country this occurred in. But if you can make it look like an accident, even if it's kind of a strange accident, and even though there's a lot of questions, the story doesn't really go anywhere.
Right, right. Ultimately, right.
Yeah. But what are some of the things that where there's a lot more questions? I mean, I guess 9/11 is one of those places. Like a lot of people are scared to question what happened in 9/11. But there's also other things where the bulk of people will sort of get a deer in headlights look in their eyes if you start to talk about it, and it's like, let's not go there. We really can't talk about it. We're not allowed to talk about it. I don't want to go there.
Yeah, anything that can be characterized as a conspiracy theory has that something like that effect. You know, inappropriate experiments on people, you know, like the Tsetse experiment, you know, that has become, everybody knows, everybody acknowledges
right.
The Tsetse experiment, of course, but then you could mention the Guatemala
right.
experiment, which it was only a few years ago that came out.
Yes, where I forget exactly what was happening, but the U.S. government was basically had an experiment to expose prisoners to syphilis in jail to see what would happen with untreated syphilis.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was similar, and it was going on at the same time, or it overlapped with the Tuskegee experiment. I think the Tuskegee experiment was much longer lasting. That was like a 30-year thing. But the Guatemala thing, not only was it more secret, and the secret was held longer, but it was worse than Tuskegee in the sense that, at least in Tuskegee, they didn't actually give anybody syphilis. They just didn't tell them that they had it and deceived them and kept them away from it. I mean, they actually kept them away from medical treatment.
Yeah, that's an interesting case because I see these cases quite differently because I recently wrote a little article on syphilis, and I did some, you know, I kind of knew the story with syphilis, but prior to the development of penicillin antibiotics, which I guess was around World War II, the treatment for syphilis was a combination of three highly toxic metals. Mm. I can't remember. I think it was mercury, and it was this agent that was called the first magic bullet in medicine. But I think it was arsenic and mercury and one other toxic metal, and this was the treatment. And a lot of people think that late stage syphilis is really the results of years of treatment with heavy metals.
Ah.
And so if you withhold treatment from somebody under those circumstances, have you really hurt them?
I wonder if any of the Tuskegee people that died, I mean, some of them actually survived, but most of them, I think, died and probably terrible deaths. But did any of them go crazy? I wonder. Because that could be quite interesting if none of them did. But I don't know.
Yes, it would be interesting to look at it from a, because I see syphilis itself as kind of a myth. The diagnosis is very problematic. It's diagnosed on antibody tests. The treatment was highly toxic. I think the treatment model was you basically treated people with whatever you had, whether it was penicillin or the metals prior to the era of penicillin, until the antibodies disappeared, which is a strange mechanism of treatment or a strange model for treatment, because antibodies are supposed to be a good thing. And
right,
they didn't
right.
look for the actual treponeme, which is the bacteria that they should be looking for. And they didn't do diagnosis based on detection of the treponeme.
So it's got that analogy to AIDS then. HIV. I wasn't aware of that.
Yes, I should send you my article on syphilis, because I drew quite a few parallels between syphilis and AIDS. But it's like when you learn more about some of these things, you see these multiple layers where people, you know, there may be a conspiracy, but people might not understand, the people performing the conspiracy might not understand everything that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Right. But in any case, at least even after penicillin was developed, they still didn't.
Yes.
They still didn't treat these people.
Yes.
But in Guatemala, it was worse in the sense that they actually gave people syphilis and other things, I believe.
Right. I mean, there's no question that these experiments are highly unethical. You know, even if their model of syphilis is wrong, you know, the intention of giving people a disease that could eventually be fatal or have, you know, debilitating consequences, exposing them to it with no intention of treating them if they get sick is clearly unethical. So, to go back to 9/11, you said that you were in some long conversation with NIST over
Well, what happened was this was about the collapse of the Trade Center, the three buildings. A guy, a friend of mine locally here, sort of spearheaded this effort in conjunction with an organization called 9/11, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah, mm-hmm, I've heard about them, yeah.
And we had a volunteer from them who wrote a letter for us, and this fellow and I and a couple other people signed it, and we approached our congressman, Congressman Owens, to try to get him to sort of help us make sure that NIST responded to our letter.
Right.
And ultimately we did get, Owens, of course, rejects any kind of a conspiracy theory about 9/11, but
right.
But he was willing to make sure that that NIST responded. And so we did, we sent in the letter, we got a response, we sent in a second letter, both of those two letters were written by our volunteer from Architects and Engineers. And then we got a second response, and then I wrote the third letter, which kind of summarized the debate up to that point, and then we got a third response.
And was the issue in question like the speed of collapse of Building 7, or was there some other?
There were three questions. We had three questions which we posed in the first letter, and one was the free fall of Building 7 for 2.25 seconds.
Right.
One was the evidence for high temperatures, and in particular, we focused in on the metallic microspheres, iron-rich microspheres, which were
right.
detectable in the dust. And then the third question was on a paper published in the Open Journal of Chemical Physics or Physical Chemistry or Chemical Physics, I think it is. That you know, some researchers found what looks like nanothermite in the dust. Okay,
and so nanothermite is this thing that burns at an extremely hot temperature, right?
Yes. So that would be an explanation for the metallic microspheres. It creates these microspheres when it reacts.
Because wasn't the government explanation that there was like a diesel fuel fire in Building 7, but the temperature of diesel fuel is not anywhere near high enough to melt steel? Is that correct?
Right, and they backed away from that, though. Their ultimate story on 9/11 on Building 7 was that the collapse was due simply to office fires, and what they say is that it's particularities about that building structure which allowed that to happen, and therefore it's not something widely generalizable. It's not like now we have to worry that a bunch of skyscrapers can collapse just because of office fires, but this one did.
Interesting. I mean, my understanding is that there's been a lot of really terrible fires in very tall buildings, and a lot of people have died in those fires, but there's never been a case of any significant building collapse before, and certainly nothing close to freefall.
Yeah, nothing like this. Yeah. And so what happened? So we asked these three questions, and they in their second letter, let's see. They gave some response, and we in our second letter we only responded to their first the response to our first question, which was about the freefall. Because
right.
they said, and one of the things, we made a kind of a tactical error in that we asked that first question, which really sort of had two parts. One was, how do you explain the free fall? And the other is, you know, how do you explain the difference between the video evidence, the video of the collapse, and, you know, your own NIST's animation that
right.
is a product of their model. Because in their model, the building twists and contorts. In a
right.
way that doesn't happen in the video, it just doesn't
right.
happen. So their response is that the video, they just didn't address the free fall, which was the main point of the question.
Right.
They didn't address that. They just said that they thought that the collapse and the video, you know, agreed quite well. so we said, you know, how can you say that? Essentially, in our second letter.
Right, and presumably the twist is necessary. That they would say that the structure mechanically broke as opposed to melted, and you needed a twist in order to break the steel. Is that what they were trying to do?
Well, they have this model. You know, it's a mathematical model. Probably a finite element analysis. So you've got each little part
right.
is you know mathematically put in there, and then you know the computer tells you what will happen, and that's
right.
the best they could do. You know, is get this model that twists and contorts,
right.
But it didn't twist and contort, so their model doesn't resemble reality. So, but they say you know it agrees quite well. So we said, well, how can you do that? And we put pictures, you know, of their model and of the you know frames of the actual collapse.
Right.
How can you say this agrees quite well? And their response, and so this would be their second response. Um, Okay, let me actually read to you what they said. They said, the claim that the timing of the collapse in the models developed by NIST agrees quite well with the video evidence of the collapse refers to the time period from the start of the cascading failure of the floors surrounding column 79 to global collapse as indicated by the initial downward motion of the north face roofline. Okay, so what that means is, the key part there is, the part that agrees quite well is up to the initial downward motion of the north face. So in other words, up to it agrees quite well up to the point where something starts to happen.
Yes, but you only really care about the fact from when the building
from when
started
the thing
to go
starts
down.
To happen, because that's when now something actually does happen before that. They say, oh well, there's the popping out of the windows and the penthouse starts to collapse, and our model agrees quite well with that. But we weren't asking about that. We were asking about the contortions and the period of time of the 2.2 seconds of free fall. And they say it agrees quite well up to the point just before that.
Yes, yes.
And so it's that kind of obviously evasive and misleading kind of answer. I mean, it took the second letter to tease that out. The first letter, they just said, well, it agrees quite well.
Right.
And then they have to get them to admit. Yeah.
And said something really totally irrelevant.
Right, something totally irrelevant agrees quite well. And so then the third letter, I summarized the correspondence thus far and explained why I thought it was inadequate, and their final response was basically, look at section this and look at section that, and which we think we've already answered that in this 10,000-page document. So.
Yes. That's really interesting. But one of the things we haven't talked about yet, you know, we've talked about conspiracy theories, but you wrote an article in response to a document by a man named Cass Sunstein about the whole Sunstein about the whole issue of that we sort of started this with of is it okay to talk about conspiracies or is as soon as you say a conspiracy theory are you wrong? So can you sort of summarize the debate between you and Sunstein?
Yeah, so Sunstein, and originally it was written with Sunstein and his Harvard colleague Adrian Vermeule, and then Sunstein went to join the Obama administration, and now he's back at Harvard. But Elena Kagan described him as the preeminent legal thinker of our time. You know, Obama had praise for him, too. I mean, this guy is regarded as sort of the top, you know, the most cited, the most wide-ranging, et cetera. So he's a big shot. And so he writes an article where he advocates that, first he tries to explain why it is that conspiracy theories, propagate. And the explanation, I argued, doesn't hold any water. But anyway, so that's part of it. And then he says, okay, what do we need to do in response? What's the cure to these things? And the cure he proposes is cognitive infiltration. And what he means there is that he suggests that conspiracy theorists are sort of, they've fallen into a kind of what he calls crippled epistemology. They have a crippled epistemology. And so in order to combat that, what you need to do is you need to infiltrate groups of conspiracy theorists and pretend to be one of them, essentially, so that your ideas, they'll be open to your ideas. So you pretend to be one of them, and then you introduce cognitive diversity into their world. It's kind of ironic. I mean, a lot of these critiques of conspiracy theories, if you turn them on their head, they actually make more sense.
So basically what he's advocating is a government conspiracy to infiltrate, quote, conspiracy theorists to maybe add divergent conspiracies so that they can be discredited because they can't make up their mind which conspiracy, which explanation to believe. But his proposal was a conspiracy, right? Like it would involve a government conspiracy to disrupt. In the question of AIDS, for example, which I'm very familiar with, you know, I'm on the camp that doesn't believe that HIV exists. But there's been a very long-running conspiracy theory, which is that HIV was a government germ warfare agent. And I sometimes have the suspicion that that was sort of created to cause dissension amongst the people dissenting from the mainstream HIV-AIDS theory by saying it was a government conspiracy to create a germ that would kill blacks and gay people. You know, where did that come from, and why does it sort of keep recurring within on the edges of the AIDS dissident movement?
Right. And one move that they have then, once there's the diversity of critiques, they can say, well, even the critics don't agree. So that's what's one of the problems is the critics don't agree, so they must be wrong. They must be all wrong.
Well, yes. I mean, the way I look at it, I mean, there's another disagreement within the whole AIDS theory. There's people like Professor Peter Duisberg who believes that HIV exists, but it's not pathogenic. And then there's, I think, a majority who now question the very existence of HIV. That's a genuine scientific disagreement, and I don't think there was anybody introduced to that. There's just people came to different conclusions. And my feeling is if you allow an open scientific discussion, you will naturally get disagreements on fairly major issues because people see it differently. And there's nothing wrong. If you have an open discussion, you can't expect everybody to think exactly the same way. You have that theory. You have people's thoughts lined up when you impose some pressure on them to all think the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
So you objected to him on basically his analysis of why there are conspiracy theories.
I sort of objected to just about everything he said. I mean, he abused history when he talked about COINTELPRO as if it was this innocuous, you know, information gathering thing.
Right.
So there was that, and his characterization. He talks about informational and reputational cascades. That was his explanation of conspiracy theories. That people propagate conspiracy theories propagate because, you know, if you get people together and a couple of them express a support for a conspiracy theory, then even if you may not agree, you know, you're less likely to take a contrary position than your friends, and then the next person comes, and there's even a stronger reason for him to go along with it. The problem with that is if you turn it on its head, it makes more sense, because what's critical is getting the initial, you know, getting in there early in the cascade pattern. Well, what theory was there, you know, had the initial momentum? It was the official story.
Yeah.
So it actually explains the pervasiveness of the official story much better than it explains conspiracy theorists, because actually, and especially reputational conspiracy theorists, and especially for people like David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott and all sorts of, you know, academics like myself. I mean, the idea that I increase my reputation among my colleagues by going around espousing conspiracy theories, I mean, it's laughable.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was very resistant to rethinking the whole 9/11 thing because I just didn't want to go there. Like, it's not really my deal. It's not my thing. You know, it's not my area where I have any particular expertise. And I would have rather the whole thing just went away. But it's like a simple, you know, the pieces of data that I had that seemed unquestionable, I could not explain with the mainstream theory.
Yeah, so it's rather, despite rather strong cascades flowing the other way,
right. These
things persist.
Yeah.
Could it possibly be because people are looking at evidence and they're finding it compelling? I mean.
Well, yes. I mean, another thing that's often considered a conspiracy theory is the whole vaccination thing, which I'm quite interested in, and I hope to soon interview somebody on the other side of the vaccination story. But, you know, if you... in the last guests I had, I mean, they had data on the statistics on diseases and showed that in many cases the diseases had basically eliminated themselves prior to the availability of the vaccine. But now we've sort of turned history around and saying the vaccine eliminated the disease, and you just have to look at the graph to see that that's not true. That doesn't prove the vaccine didn't help, but
right.
It certainly wasn't the whole answer.
Right. Yeah, and it could be a middle position, too. I mean, it could be that, you know, that they were, that it could be a mixed bag.
Yeah, it could be, but there seems to be sometimes no middle ground. I mean, it's like I read some stuff about 9/11, and I thought, you know, this is just crazy. Like, some people were talking about this was all done with computer graphics, and, you know, there really weren't planes flying into towers, and it was all sort of a big computer game done somewhere, and it just didn't make any sense to me. It was just crazy. I mean, I think there's some, you know, some things that people have said are probably totally wrong, and I'm sure that many people who are interested in 9/11 probably dismiss some of the crazier theories
sure.
about what happened.
Sure, so the crazier ones could be, you know, a cognitive infiltration or whatever, you know, some kind of CIA, or they could be just, you know, some guy who got a crazy idea. And it doesn't really matter.
There's definitely some crazy people out there.
Yeah, there are crazy people out there. And that's right. And some of, you know, and it doesn't really matter which it is, but either way, it doesn't mean that there couldn't possibly have been any insider complicity. I mean, there's just no logical connection there.
Yes, yes. I mean, really, the answer is something you said earlier, is that we have a responsibility. If something important happens, we have the responsibility to do our own research with the data that we can get. And I think that says that access to information is critically important. I mean, it's like, take Edward Snowden. Pre-Edward Snowden, we didn't know that the government was spying on everything, but there were a lot of people who would say that, and they were seen as conspiracy theorists.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's just crazy. Like, they couldn't do it, they wouldn't want to, all kinds of excuses why that's not really true. And what we see with Edward Snowden is, well, they didn't get everything, but they were trying to get everything, and given enough time, they would have monitored every electronic communication in the United States.
Right.
And I'm sure they're still trying to do that. The question is whether the knowledge that we have will push back against that kind of thing, and will rein in these hidden government programs or not. It's still open.
Yeah. Well, they got pretty close, I think, you know.
I think they basically got everything that was important, but there's always something else. There's always some new social network. There's always some new form of communication. So, I mean, it was a money-spinning operation, because every time somebody opens up and, you know, something like Twitter comes along that's new, then, you know, it's $1 billion worth of contracts to figure out how to crack Twitter and how to intercept it and all that kind of stuff. And now, with all the strengthening of security, I'm sure there's a lot of people saying, oh, this is really good, because, you know, if we can, even if we can't break this, we can still do tons and tons of research into how we could possibly break these stronger security mechanisms, and all that really matters is the money.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, I think sometimes there are things that the government does, like Star Wars, for example, is a completely futile thing. It couldn't work, you know, apart from all the other arguments.
Right.
But it generated billions of dollars in contracts for well-connected people, which is probably why it was so protected for so many years.
Right. And I think there is a lot of that.
I mean, usually there's government, or there's money or power at stake with all of these conspiracy theories, and something's being protected.
Right. And that's one thing that Lance DeHaven Smith concludes with his SCAD analysis, looking at you know, a whole bunch of these things together, and saying, well, how many of them involve this, and how many of that, and sort of the military-industrial complex, and sort of feeding that. You know, it's always the more dovish guy that gets assassinated when there's somebody who's less dovish waiting in the wings to take over, like Kennedy and Johnson.
Right.
So you see that kind of a pattern. And why would anybody want more war? Well, somebody's making money off it.
It's a very profitable business. I mean, I see American foreign policy in a totally different light now. I don't see it as dysfunctional at all. I see it as ensuring that there's always money to be made for the military-industrial complex by having a perpetual state of war, which basically means that whenever one war winds down, like Iraq or Afghanistan, you have to start trying to start a war somewhere else in order to keep the money flowing, because too many years of peace, people are going to be saying, you know, why are we spending $10 billion on these newfangled new bombers that we never use? You know, so you got to find an excuse to use them, and then maybe a few will crash or they'll wear out, and then you can replace them or come out with new things. I guess drones are the big thing now because they're getting more and more complicated, more and more expensive, and there's a huge amount of money. But if they stopped flying them, then the demand of the U.S. government for drones would dry up very quickly, and so would the profits.
And there's usually a complex of ideas. I mean, so the money is a part of it, you know, and geostrategy is a part of it,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, securing power in one way or another is a part of it. And so with the drones, you know, they'll probably be having drones with cameras flying over the United States not too long from now. And you know, the invasion into privacy and the diminishing our rights, you know, that's a part of it because that plays into the power aspect. So you've got it's not just one thing. Like when people say, "Oh, Iraq was about oil," it wasn't just about oil.
For the politicians, you have to have a story for the politicians that gets them saying, "Yeah, I can sell this to the public." You know, weapons of mass destruction. We need that to sell it to the public. And then there has to be another reason for it to be supported by the military-industrial complex. And another reason for it to be supported by the oil companies. And if you can get all these forces together, then you can really get somewhere.
And you don't even need an explicit conspiracy sometimes for that, right? Just because if somebody's interests are enough, you know, accommodated by a certain way of doing things, then they're going to... they know what to do to kind of go along with that and let that happen and make sure that it doesn't get, you know, exposed or whatever.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that's another whole other area, things that look like a conspiracy but actually occur because everybody just thinks the same, and you can sort of trigger this group action just by triggering something that's built into them. We've kind of reached the end of our hour, and I would just like to say that this was a very interesting discussion, and I hope our audience also found it interesting, and I'd like to thank you for coming on the show, The Infectious Myths, with me.
Well, thank you, David, and you know, I think you do important work, and I'm happy to be on.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you, and we'll be talking again in the future. And if you're listening to the show, don't forget that you can email me at david.crow, crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Thanks for listening to yet another episode, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye.